The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro. Part 1, continued on cassette number 3, side 1. The more the damn legislature meets, the more goddamn bills and taxes it passes, one Texan put it. And when Texans regained control of their state government, their new state constitution, essentially an anti-government document, tried to ensure that the legislature would meet infrequently. It provided that sessions be held only every other year, and, as an inducement to legislators to keep even these sessions short, that the legislator's salary of $5 per day be paid only for 60 days. If the sessions ran longer, they were to receive $2 per day. Low salaries didn't bother many of the legislators, for it was not legislators but lobbyists. Lobbyists for oil companies, railroads, banks, utilities, who did the presiding in Austin. In the capital's bars and brothels, where they dispensed beefsteak, bourbon, and blondes so liberally that some descriptions of turn-of-the-century legislative sessions read like descriptions of one long orgy. In its back rooms, where decisions were made, even on the floor of the legislature, which lobbyists roamed at will, often sitting at legislators' desks and sometimes even casting votes on behalf of absent representatives. Many of the elected representatives of a generally impoverished people, representatives who had come to Austin poor themselves, went home poor no more, and even most of those who refused to trade votes for cash generally accepted, because they considered their salaries too low to cover their expenses, lobbyists' offers to pay for their Austin meals and hotel bills. The use of blondes to influence the legislature was so widespread that one legislator, a preacher, introduced a bill that would have made adultery a felony. The joke in Austin was that its passage would result in the immediate jailing of most legislators. So one by one, almost every legislator stood up and proposed an amendment, which the House laughingly passed, by prearrangement, exempting residents of his own district, including, of course, himself, from the bill. But Sam Johnson accepted nothing. It was not that he shunned the whorehouses and the bars. He didn't. He is remembered as an enthusiastic participant in the wildest of Austin's parties. He is remembered, in fact, as being a loud and boastful reveler, somewhat foolish when in his cups. But if he was foolish, he was foolish on his own money. He insisted on paying for his own drinks and his own women. And if he is remembered as being loud, he is also remembered as being honest, conspicuously honest. A rather quixotic figure, in fact, in the Austin atmosphere. Once finding a lobbyist sitting at his desk in the House, he angrily ordered him up. When the lobbyist, thinking he was joking, was too slow to obey, Johnson reached down, grabbed his jacket, and pulled him out of his chair. Thereafter, he either introduced or was one of the few supporters of, the legislative record is not clear on the point, a bill to regulate lobbyists' conduct. It never got out of committee. The most controversial issue before the Texas House of Representatives in 1907 was the re-election of United States Senator Joseph Weldon Bailey. Bailey, an imposing figure in his dull black frock coat, flowing tie, and big black slouch hat, was one of the great old populist orators. His thundering speeches against Eastern capitalists, wrote one who had heard them, were phrased in the best English, though he was prone to draw on his imagination for history when required to make his point. His voice was melodious. As minority leader of Congress during the 1890s, he dominated the Democratic minority like an overseer and conducted himself like a conqueror. A close friend of Bryan's, he had influenced the great commoner in the formulation of his most celebrated doctrines, among them the Bryan Metal Theory. But according to his enemies, Bailey was a populist who had sold out. In 1906, he was accused of having accepted huge legal fees from railroads, the big East Texas lumber interests, and the Standard Oil Company. From Standard Oil alone, he later admitted, his annual retainer was $100,000. Four times as large as the budget, including the governor's salary, of the entire executive branch of the state of Texas. His term as senator ran out in 1907. Some members of the legislature, legislatures still elected senators, were talking of getting a new one, or at least of postponing the vote while the House investigated Bailey's affairs. When the legislature met, however, Bailey was in Austin to drive into the Gulf of Mexico the peanut politicians who would replace me with someone who would rattle around in my seat like a mustard seed in a gourd. Backing him were the railroads and oil interests, who had a big stake in keeping him in the Senate. They wanted a vote before any investigation began. They wanted the vote unanimous. The pressure they brought to bear, combined with the power of Bailey's name — the senator was at that time possibly the most famous and powerful politician in Texas — brought sooner or later almost all of the 133 members of the House over to their point of view. When the vote on his re-election was held, following a series of pro-Bailey speeches greeted with roaring cheers by most of the members, only 7 refused to go along. Sam Johnson, who had been one of the first to call for the investigation, was one of the 7. To some Austin observers, Sam Johnson's stand, not only on Bailey, but on all the populist positions that he refused to surrender, made him something of a hero. The House chaplain, who described him as a quiet worker whose pleasant, gentlemanly ways secure to him the friendship of all the members, said he will bear gentle reproof, but will kick like a mule at any attempted domination. Others put it more simply. The saying about Sam Johnson was widespread in Austin at this time. Sam Johnson, it went, as straight as a shingle. But the legislative session dragged on. On $5 a day, and then $2 a day, Sam had to pay his expenses at Austin, as well as the salaries of the laborers he had to hire to work the farm when he was away. He couldn't do it, and his creditors were dunning him for the money he had lost in the cotton futures market, and for smaller amounts, too. In August 1905, for example, he had filled a 40-cent prescription at O.Y. Fawcett's drugstore in Johnson City. In November, he still hadn't been able to pay the 40 cents, and when he came in for another prescription, Fawcett made him pay cash. At the end of the year, Fawcett asked him if he could pay up so that the account would be balanced, and Sam said he couldn't. He began to get a bad reputation with some of the local merchants, bad enough, in fact, so that when, in 1907, he asked the Johnson City girl, a schoolteacher named Mabel Chapman, to marry him, Mabel, at the insistence of her parents, refused, and instead married another suitor. And then in August 1907, he did get married, and by 1908 he and his wife were expecting a child. He may have felt at home in that paneled, high-ceilinged House of Representatives, but it was a house he couldn't afford to stay in. All 4 counties in the 89th District wanted him to run again in 1908 for an unprecedented 3rd term, but he decided not to do so. State jobs, better paying than legislative seats, were available to many retiring legislators, as were jobs with the railroads and the oil companies and the banks. But Sam Johnson, who had refused to go along with the railroads and the oil companies and the banks, who had refused to come to terms with the reality of Austin, was offered no job. By the time his first child, Lyndon, was born on August 27, 1908, Sam Johnson had lugged his dreams and ideals back to the Hill Country. Chapter 4. The Father and Mother. Sam Johnson had, moreover, married someone as romantic and idealistic as he. Rebecca Baines had been raised, on the outskirts of the little Hill Country town of Blanco, in a large 2-story stone house painted a smooth and gleaming white. A house of southern graciousness, it should have been set behind a long green lawn, among tall and stately trees. Instead, it towered over the stunted mesquite around it, and over the spindly little fruit trees in the recently planted orchard on one side. Grass grew in its front yard only in brown, scattered clumps. It seemed very out of place near Blanco's rickety wooden stores and dog-run log cabins. For a while, Rebecca's father was the area's most prominent attorney. Descended from a long line of famous Baptist preachers, his father, the Reverend George Washington Baines, had been president of Baylor, the Texas Baptist University. Joseph Wilson Baines had been a schoolteacher and then a lawyer, a newspaper man, founder of the influential McKinney Advocate, and Secretary of State under Governor John Old Oxcart Ireland. Moving to the Hill Country in 1900, he was elected to the legislature, to the same seat Sam Johnson would later hold, and practiced law and rented land to tenant farmers, accumulating quite a fortune. But the qualities most remarked about him were his piety. A Baptist, strict in doctrine, he was the chief pillar in the Blanco Church. For clean speech and morals, he could hardly have been surpassed. his love of beauty and literature and nature, and his principles, both as a legislator, public-spirited, profoundly concerned for the welfare of the people, high in ideals, and as a lawyer who, his law partner said, was always more concerned about doing right and acting honorable than he was about the success of the suit. A hill country historian wrote of Joe Baines, "He loved the good and the beautiful." Rebecca was devoted to her father. It was he, she was to recall, who taught her to read, and reading has been one of the great pleasures and sustaining forces of my life. He taught me the beauty of simple things. He taught me that a lie is an abomination to the Lord. He gave the timid child self-confidence. As an elderly woman, looking back with some exaggeration on her girlhood, she would write, "I am grateful for that simple, friendly, dearly loved town, Blanco. I love to think of our home, a two-story rock house with a fruitful orchard of perfectly spaced trees, terraced flower beds, broad walks, purple-plumed wisteria climbing to the roof, fragrant honeysuckle at the dining-room windows, whose broad sills were seats for us children. Most of all, I love to think of the gracious hospitality of that home, of the love and trust, the fear of God, and the beautiful ideals that made it a true home." But Blanco was in the hill country. On account of disastrous droughts, protracted 4 years, and by overkindness to farm tenants and by overconfidence in men, as his brother put it, Baines's farming operations brought financial ruin. He lost his home, moving in 1904 from dearly loved Blanco to the German community of Fredericksburg, where he built a smaller house for his family and tried to establish a new practice. But his health had fled with his fortune, and he died in November 1906. His wife had to sell the house, move to San Marcos, and take in boarders. Rebecca later wrote that she had adjusted readily and cheerfully to the financial change. She worked in the college bookstore to earn enough money to graduate from Baylor, but that she had experienced greater difficulty adjusting to life without my father, who had been the dominant force in my life as well as my adored parent, reverenced mentor, and most interesting companion. Shortly before he died, while Rebecca, having graduated, was back in Fredericksburg teaching elocution and working as a stringer for the Austin newspaper, he had suggested that she interview the young legislator who had won the seat he himself had once held. She would recall that when she did, in 1907, shortly after Sam had been turned down by Mabel Chapman, "I asked him lots of questions, but he was pretty cagey and I couldn't pin him down. I was awfully provoked with that man." But she also recalled that he was dashing and dynamic, with flashing eyes. And however unlike her father he may have been in other respects, the two men were similar in the one she thought most important. She could talk with him, as she had with her father, about principles. As for Sam, she said, he was enchanted to find a girl who really liked politics. Soon, in what she called a whirlwind courtship, he was riding the 20 miles to Fredericksburg to visit the slender, blonde, blue-eyed elocution teacher, and taking her to hear political speeches at the Confederate reunion and in the legislature. We heard William Jennings Bryan, who we both admired extravagantly. And on August 20th, 1907, they were married, and he brought her to the Purdon Alice. Nothing in her life had prepared her for life there. As they rode away from comfortable, bustling Fredericksburg and its neat green fields, the land faded to brown and then gray. It became more and more rocky, more and more barren. The farmhouses were farther and farther apart. Dotting the hills were hulks of deserted farmhouses, crumbling rectangles of logs out of which reared tall stone fireplaces, which stood in the hills like tombstones, monuments to the hopes of other couples who had tried to earn a living there. And then, finally, they came to the house in which she was to live. It was a small shack on a long, shallow slope leading up from the muddy little river. A typical hill country dog run, it consisted of two box-like rooms, each about 12 feet square, on either side of a breezeway. Behind one of the rooms was the kitchen. One end of the porch had been enclosed to form a tiny shed room. The roof was sagging as if pulled down a little by the added weight on that side, and the porch slanted down too. The walls of the house were vertical boards. Out back were a barn, little more, really, than a lean-to shelter for animals, and the toilet facilities, a pair of flimsy, tilted two-holers. In front of the house was a swinging wooden gate, not set in a wooden fence, but in a fence made of four strands of barbed wire, which enclosed the front yard. The yard was mostly dirt, with a few clumps of grass or weeds stuck up here and there. Sam had painted the house a bright yellow to welcome her. Rebecca's father had created a niche in the hill country, and had raised a daughter who fitted into that niche. A college graduate, a lover of poetry, a soft-spoken, gentle, dreamy-eyed young lady who wore crinolines and lace, and broad-brimmed, beribboned hats with long veils. She had a flawless, beautiful white skin and never held with this business of going out in the sun and getting tan. She felt that women should protect themselves from the sun, recalls one of her daughters. Now, overnight, at the age of 26, Sam was almost 30, she was out of the niche. A fragile southern flower, suddenly transplanted to the rocky soil of the Perdinalis Valley. Transplanted, moreover, to a world in which women had to work, and work hard. On wash days, clothes had to be lifted out of the big soaking vats of boiling water on the ends of long poles, the clothes dripping and heavy. The farm filth had to be scrubbed out in hours of kneeling over rough rub boards, hours in which the lye and homemade soap burned the skin off women's hands. The heavy flat irons had to be continually carried back and forth to the stove for reheating, and the stove had to be continually fed with new supplies of wood. Decades later, even strong, sturdy farm wives would remember how their backs had ached on wash day. And Rebecca wasn't strong. With no electricity in the valley, all cooking had to be done on a wood stove, and the wood for it, and for the fireplace, had to be carried in from the pile outside. And just carrying those countless loads of wood was hard for a frail woman who had never in her life done physical labor. The pump on her back porch made it unnecessary for Rebecca to lug buckets of water up from the Perdinalis, as most of the women in the valley had to do, but even working the pump was hard for her. Rebecca was a good cook, but of what the other farm wives called fancy foods, delicate dishes for elegant meals. Now, at the threshing, the 15 or 20 men who came in to help expected to be served 3 huge meals a day. The farm wife had 100 chores. Sam hired girls to help Rebecca with them, but the girls were always quitting. No girl wanted to live out there in those lonely hills. And even when there was a maid in the house, there was so much work that Rebecca had to do some of it. When, in later years, Rebecca Johnson wrote a memoir, she painted her life on the ranch in terms so soft that it was all but unrecognizable to those who knew her. But seeping through the lines of one paragraph is emotion they believe is true. Normally, the first year of marriage is a period of readjustment. In this case, I was confronted not only by the problem of adjustment to a completely opposite personality, but also to a strange and new way of life, a way far removed from that I had known in Blanco and Fredericksburg. Recently, my early experiences on the farm were relived when I saw the egg and die. Again, I shuddered over the chickens and wrestled with a mammoth iron stove. However, I was determined to overcome circumstances instead of letting them overwhelm me. At last I realized that life is real and earnest, and not the charming fairy tale of which I had so long dreamed. Years later, in a statement that may have been more accurate, she would write to her son Lyndon, "I never liked country life and its inconveniences." It was not, however, the work that was the most difficult aspect of farm life for her. From Rebecca's front porch, not another house was visible, not another human structure of any type. Other houses were scattered along the Perdinalis, and some not far away. Sam's parents now lived just a half mile up the road, and not much farther away lived 2 of Sam's sisters with their husbands. And there was his brother Tom. It was a Johnson Valley again. There were Johnson brothers, again named Sam and Tom, working on the Perdinalis as there had been 40 years before. But the Johnsons were a boisterous crew. They told jokes, the kind of jokes Rebecca's father had so disliked. They might pass around a bottle, and her father had taught her what a sin that was. Going to church on Sundays was great fun for them. They would all meet at Grandfather Johnson's, each family behind its own team, and race, shouting back and forth, pulling up in front of the Christadelphian church in a flurry of dust and laughter. That wasn't the way to go to church. After services, they would gather around the piano in the church and sing. All the Johnsons could sing. Sam had once won a medal in a singing contest. It was not at all like the quiet, reflective Sundays in the Baptist church in Blanco that had been so important to Rebecca's father and to her. In other ways, too, she couldn't fit in. She was a college graduate, and a college graduate who loved what she had learned, who loved to recite poetry and to talk about literature and art, and who had spent her life in a home filled with such talk. The other Johnson women were farm wives, raised on farms. When necessary, they worked in the fields beside their men. Rebecca's sister-in-law, Tom's wife, was a sturdy German girl, quite capable, if Tom fell behind in the plowing, of hitching up a second team and handling a whole quarter section by herself. In conversation, the Johnson women were as earthy as Rebecca was ethereal. Many of them had their letters, and that was all. They could sign their names and laboriously pick out words in a newspaper, but they didn't read books and didn't talk about them. Some of the women on nearby farms in the valley and in the rolling hills that stretched away from it didn't even have their letters. The German women didn't even speak English. Without a telephone, Rebecca could talk only with the people in the valley, and there wasn't a person in the valley with whom Rebecca enjoyed talking. Sam was opposite, loud and boisterous, impatient and cursed with a fierce temper, but he and Rebecca were very much in love. She was so shy and reserved all the time, says a girl who lived with them on the Perdinalis for several months. Then she'd hear Sam coming home. Her face would just light up like a little kid's, and out she'd go flying down to the gate to meet him. They loved to talk together, long, serious talks, usually about politics. The girl recalls the two of them sitting beside the coal oil lamp late into the evening, talking about things I couldn't understand. But when Sam was away, Rebecca had no one to talk to. And Sam was often away, traveling to Austin on legislative business or to Johnson City to deliver cotton to the gin or pick up supplies, or all over the vast hill country to buy and sell farms. In 1908, he had decided to try to supplement his farm income by going into the real estate business. And it wasn't always possible to come straight home when his business was concluded. More than once, having spurred a mount or whipped a team through the 60 miles of mud that constituted the only road between Austin and Stonewall in a wet spell, he would come to a creek too high to ford. When Rebecca walked out the front door of that little house, there was nothing. A roadrunner streaking behind some rocks with something long and wet dangling from his beak, perhaps. Or a rabbit disappearing around a bush so fast that all she really saw was the flash of a white tail. But otherwise nothing. There was no movement, except for the ripple of the leaves in the scattered trees, no sound except for the constant whisper of the wind, unless by happy chance crows were cawing somewhere nearby. If Rebecca climbed, almost in desperation, the hill in back of the house, what she saw from its crest was more hills, an endless vista of hills, hills on which there was visible not a single house. Somewhere up there, of course, was the Benner house and the Weinheimer house and barn, but they were hidden from her by some rise. Hills on which nothing moved, empty hills with above them empty sky. A hawk circling silently high overhead was an event. But most of all, there was nothing human, no one to talk to. If men loved Texas, women, even the Anglo-pioneer women, hated it, Fehrenbach has written. In diaries and letters, 1,000 separate farm wives left a record of fear that this country would drive them mad. Not only brutally hard work, but loneliness. What Walter Prescott Webb, who grew up on a farm and could barely restrain his bitterness toward historians who glamorize farm life, calls nauseating loneliness, was the lot of a hill country farm wife. Loneliness and dread. During the day there might be a visitor, or at least an occasional passer-by on the rutted road. At night there was no one, no one at all. No matter in what direction Rebecca looked, not a light was visible. The gentle, dreamy, bookish woman would be alone, alone in the dark, sometimes when clouds covered the moon in pitch dark. Alone in the dark when she went out on the porch to pump water, or out to the barn to feed the horses. Alone with the rustlings in the trees and the sudden splashes in the river, which could be a fish jumping, or a small animal drinking, or someone coming. alone in the storms when the wind howled around the house and tore through its flimsy walls, blowing out the lamps and candles. Alone in the night, in the horrible nights, after a norther, when the freeze came, and ice drove starving rodents from the fields to gnaw at the roofs and walls, and she could hear them chewing there in the dark. Alone in bed, with no human being to hear you if you should call. She tried to maintain her standards. Her favorite quotation, she said, was one from Browning. "The common problem, yours and mine, everyone's, is not to fancy what were fair in life, provided it could be, but finding first what may be and how to make it fair up to our means." She refused to use the customary oilcloth on her table. She used tablecloths, no matter how much work it was to wash and iron them. She made a ritual out of little things, like serving tea in very thin cups, one of her daughters says. Never, even in her old age, was she able to reconcile herself to the fact that three of her five, they came at two-year intervals, children, were delivered by a midwife. When labor pains began for her first child, Lyndon, her husband sent for a doctor, but the nearest one was 20 miles away, and the creeks were on the rise. As morning approached, the pains came closer together, it became obvious that he wouldn't arrive in time. Sam Johnson Sr., 69 years old, saddled his most reliable horse, Old Reb, rode along the Perdinalis until, half a mile above the usual ford, he found a low spot, and then spurred the horse into the raging water to bring back a German midwife, Mrs. Christian Lindig, and it was she who presided at the delivery. When, in 1951, Lyndon asked his mother to jot down some family reminiscences, she did not mention Mrs. Lindig as among those present at his birth, but credited as the attending physician, Dr. John Blanton of Buda, who actually didn't arrive until quite a few hours later. Says Sam's sister Jessie, "Rebecca was always, always dignified, you know, in everything. I don't think Rebecca would have ever wanted anybody to say that Lyndon came with a midwife instead of a real doctor. I don't think she would ever have said." There was one other character-revealing note in the episode. As old Sam, the gallant, unselfish Johnson, saddled his horse, his wife Eliza, who was a Bunton and believed that charity begins at home, tried to stop him from going, shouting, "You will be drowned," as he rode off. In 1913, after Lyndon and two girls had been born, Sam and Rebecca moved into Johnson City, into a snug three-bedroom white-frame house with lacy Victorian gingerbread scrollwork on the gables and with trellises on which she soon had wisteria growing. But gingerbread and wisteria couldn't make Johnson City into Blanco or Fredericksburg. Stella Glidden, who moved there from Fredericksburg about the same time as Rebecca, says, "When I came to Johnson City, I thought I had come to the end of the earth." She couldn't believe the primitiveness of the living conditions she found there, Mrs. Glidden says. Registering at the only hotel in town, already appalled at its rickety shabbiness, she asked where the bathroom was, and was told there wasn't any, not even a sink to wash in. Nor, she was told, did most homes in Johnson City have indoor plumbing. "I don't think there were three bathrooms in the whole town," she recalls, meaning by bathrooms, rooms with sinks and bathtubs. No one in Johnson City had a toilet in the house. When she asked where she could eat, she was told that there was one cafe in town, but that it was only open when the proprietors, King and Fanny Casparis, felt like opening it, and that they hadn't felt like it for some time. Another visitor recalls going to Casparis's cafe at noon one day and finding on its door a sign he considered somewhat unusual for a restaurant: "Closed for lunch." Since there was, therefore, no place in Johnson City where a meal could be purchased, Mrs. Glidden decided to make herself a sandwich. But when she went shopping, she learned, to her astonishment, that no local store stocked bread because there wasn't enough demand for it. You couldn't buy a loaf of bread in Johnson City. Fredericksburg was a town with only 4,000 residents, but its homes were solid German rock houses with arbors and orchards, and indoor plumbing. It had handsome churches and a large, sprawling hotel, and a long main street lined with bustling shops. Johnson City looked like the set for a Grade B Western. Its single commercial street, Main Street, unpaved, of course, was a row of a few one-story stores, each with a wooden awning supported by poles, extending over the rickety wooden sidewalk that ran in front of them. It was almost wholly a one-story town. The only larger structures were a rickety water tower, a corrugated tin cotton gin, the bank, Doc Barnwell's sanitarium, which had 4 or 5 beds upstairs over his office, and 2 square two-story stone buildings, the school and the courthouse. Scattered around that main street were a few homes, very few. About 1916, 2 of the Redford boys, Cecil and Emmett, climbed into the school belfry, from whose platform they could see about 5 miles in every direction. Counting children and hired hands, because, Cecil says, we knew every person in every house anywhere around, the total population of the area, as far as the eye could see, was 323. The sense of isolation, of being cut off from the rest of the world, was overwhelming, Mrs. Glidden remembers. From the top of Lookout Mountain, about 4 miles away, it was possible to see farther than from the school belfry, and from its crest, the hills, ridge after ridge, rolled endlessly away in an awesome empty landscape. And then one looked down and saw Johnson City, a tiny cluster of houses huddled together in the midst of immense space. Cars and roads would one day bridge that space, but when Sam and Rebecca moved to Johnson City, there were almost no cars, 3 or 4 in the town, and no paved roads for cars to travel on. Even by car it took long hours to reach Fredericksburg or Austin, when the roads and creeks were passable. Often they weren't, and then someone who wanted to go to Fredericksburg or Austin had to be brought out of Johnson City as if out of darkest Africa. Once I wanted to go home to Fredericksburg for Christmas, Mrs. Glidden recalls. I had to have a man with a hack and horse take me out to Stonewall, and a car was able to come out from Fredericksburg to there and take me the rest of the way. Johnson City was, she says, an island town, a town surrounded by and cut off by an ocean of land. Rebecca saw it the same way, and its people, while friendly, the people in Johnson City were the friendliest, warmest people I met anywhere, Mrs. Glidden says, were not people who could provide Rebecca with the things so important to her. She was probably the best-educated woman in the whole county, her son Sam Houston has written, and she probably was. She was the only woman with a college degree in Johnson City. No more than 2 or 3 residents of the town, of either gender, had spent any time at all in college. Johnson City was, in fact, a town with hardly any books except for the textbooks used in school. One farmer, Robert Lee Green, was so desperate for something to read that when there was some evening event at school, he would sneak out of the auditorium and down to the high school classroom and sit there reading a history textbook until it was time to go home. Worst of all for Rebecca, the schools were terribly inadequate. Her children, she believed, were getting hardly any education at all. Once, when her mother came to visit, she said to her, with desperation in her voice, "I don't want to bring up my children in Johnson City." Shortly after they moved to Johnson City, their 4th child, Sam Houston, was born. Rebecca had wanted to have her confinement in the sanitarium, but Doc Barnwell told her that its handful of beds was needed for patients more seriously ill. Although the doctor was present this time, the birth was hard. Recuperating from the delivery took several weeks, and for years thereafter Rebecca Johnson would periodically take to her bed for days or weeks at a time. She had always hated the drudgery of routine housework, and now she all but stopped doing it. Her mother came to visit more and more, staying for weeks at a time to help out, and Sam hired a local girl to come in and clean. Rebecca's neighbors said that what the mother and the maid didn't do remained undone. Nor, the neighbor said, was Rebecca thrifty. In this desperately cash-poor country where pennies mattered, women watched them. Make or make do, was the saying. The reason there was no bread for sale in Johnson City was that the baker in Marble Falls, who had to cart it in by wagon, wanted 5 cents a loaf. Rather than spend that money, Johnson City women baked their own bread, although that task required them to spend the entire day adjusting the fire in their stoves, continually putting in wood to keep it at the correct temperature. Johnson City women scrubbed their floors on their hands and knees. Brooms, Ava Johnson Cox, Lyndon's cousin, remembers, were too expensive, so you didn't dare use them every day. Rebecca didn't live like that. In the opinion of her neighbors, she couldn't. Says Ava, whose mother received $10 from her husband, Tom, every month for household expenses, and by making or making do, always had $2 left at the month's end. Our mother learned as a girl how to can, how to preserve, how to do all the things that a farm woman had to do. She, Rebecca, had never been taught that, and she didn't want to learn. And a woman like Rebecca, even if she had wanted to learn, she just would never fit into the life that we had. She couldn't learn that around here every penny mattered. But at the time, Rebecca Johnson's neighbors didn't think badly of her for not working the way they did. They saw that she had other qualities, and that she was generous in their use. By volunteering her services, she persuaded the school board to start a literary society in which she taught poetry and elocution, which to her meant the whole art of public speaking. Teaching public school to these shy country girls and boys, many of whom came to school only occasionally from their isolated farms and ranches, was difficult. She started the younger students on spelling bees and arithmetic matches, which gave them their first chance to stand up in front of an audience. Then they progressed to declamation of poems, to pantomimes and dialogues, then to debates, and finally, the high school pupils would have to speak extemporaneously on subjects they would study in the books, pamphlets, and magazines Rebecca ordered from the Extension Library at the University of Texas in Austin. The girls felt keenly that they were country, that they lacked social graces, so Rebecca expanded the curriculum to include dancing. 50 years and more later, one of her pupils asked what kind of dancing, suddenly became lost in reverie, and then, all at once, began humming, very softly, with her wrinkled old face, smiling in reminiscence. Little red wagon painted blue, little red wagon painted blue, little red wagon painted blue, skipped a maloo, my darling. To records played on a Victrola, which she brought to school. The school couldn't afford one. Rebecca taught not only square dances, but waltzes and Virginia reels. And then, in the words of another elderly Johnson City resident, she teached girls how to stand, how to sit down properly. She did the work without pay. There was no money to give her, and she didn't ask for any. And her students were grateful to her. We didn't have anything before, one recalls. Before Lyndon's mother came to school and got this going, school was only sitting in class and not raise your finger or say a word or you got spanked. We didn't think they'd let her do the literary society. That was play. That was taking your mind off your books. They were grateful also for the lessons Lyndon's mother gave in private, in the living room of the Johnson home. Those lessons were the highlight of my young life, says Doc Barnwell's daughter Jean. Those lessons changed lives, in fact. One girl who received them was Linda's cousin Ava. Ava's sister Margaret was beautiful and lively and outgoing. Ava was not. She was very shy, a little stout, and although she wasn't homely, she considered herself so. Rebecca was taking one grade at a time in her literary society, working her way toward the older pupils, and Ava dreaded the day she would get to her grade. When Mrs. Johnson did and began assigning speech topics, Ava recalls, "I said I couldn't do a speech." "You come over to the house this afternoon." At the house, I said, "I just can't do it, Aunt Rebecca." And she said, "Oh, yes, you can. There's nothing impossible if you put the mind to it. I know you have the ability to deliver a speech." And I cried, and I said, "I just can't do it." Aunt Rebecca said, "Oh, yes, you can." And she said, "Pretty is just skin deep, darling." Ooh, I'll never forget her saying that. And she repeated that Browning poem to me. And she never let up, never let up, never. Boosting me along, telling me I could do it. She taught me speaking and elocution, and I went to the state championships with it. And I want to tell you I was one scared chicken. And I won a medal, a gold medal, in competitions involving the whole state. And she still kept boosting me along. I wanted to be a teacher, but I never thought I could. I just didn't think that I could ever get it over to a child. I had always wanted to be a teacher, but I couldn't sell myself. I had an inferiority complex that wouldn't quit. She told me, "You have everything that it takes to make a good teacher. Just make up your mind to do it." She never let up, telling me I could do it. And I did. And I became a teacher and taught for 18 years. I owe a debt to Aunt Rebecca that I can never repay. She made me know that I could do what I never thought I could do. Many children owed a similar debt to Rebecca Johnson. Her patience in teaching English to German-American children who spoke no English at home and often not in school either Classes in Fredericksburg and the Hill Country's other German communities were often conducted only in German. Became so legendary throughout the area that German families brought their children long miles to the Johnson home. Asked years later why he had done so, one man, from San Marcos, 30 miles away, said, "I had heard praises of Mrs. Johnson since the time when I was a child." Her husband adored her. Their marriage was a misfit, says Ava, pronouncing that last word as two words to give it the emphasis she feels it needs for accuracy. It was a misfit, but she wanted to make the best of it because she loved him. And he loved her. Oh, he adored her. He worshipped the ground she walked on. A misfit it was, in the sense that their personalities were indeed as completely opposite, as Rebecca wrote. Mrs. Johnson was always cheerful, kind, and considerate. She was a gentle, gentle woman, Mrs. Glidden wrote. Quite the contrary was her husband, Mr. Sam. If nothing could ruffle her calm, so nothing could tame his temper. The Buntons burned without matches, and his fuse was terribly short, and often his anger was directed at his wife. But it was a temper as quick to die out as to blaze up, as his wife wrote. Highly organized, sensitive, and nervous, he was impatient of inefficiency and ineptitude, and quick to voice his displeasure, especially quick, however, in making amends when some word of his caused pain to another. Once, recalls Louise Casperus, daughter of one of the poorest families in Johnson City, who worked in the Johnson home, "Mr. Sam lost his temper at me, really got mad about something I had done wrong." But when she arrived at the house the next day, there on the mantelpiece was a beautiful box of candy for me. He never said a word of apology to her, but she learned he had driven all the way to Fredericksburg to get it. Louise, and other women who worked and in some cases lived in the Johnson home, agree with neighbors and relatives that the attempts of some biographers to portray the Johnson home as one of unending and bitter conflict between husband and wife are incorrect. "That's not the home I saw," says Cynthia Crider. What most of them recall most vividly is the way Sam would kid Rebecca. About the house he had bought for her, he used to grumble kiddingly about all that gingerbread and all. About the fact that while she liked to boast of her Baines ancestry, she never mentioned her maternal Huffman line. When she got stubborn over something, Sam would say, "That's your German blood again, German blood. Look at your brother's name, Huffman. Probably it was Hoffman once in Berlin." And Rebecca would say, "Sam, you know it's Holland Dutch." They recall how you could see that underneath the kidding he had so much respect for her learning, and, well, just for her. And they recall how Sam and Rebecca would sit and talk for hours. If he had been yelling at her one minute, the next he would be making amends in his own way, telling a funny story. One minute he'd be shouting, and the next minute she'd be laughing at something he said. He could make her laugh and laugh and laugh. Sam loved to talk politics with Rebecca. She herself was to write that, in disposition, upbringing, and background, these two were vastly dissimilar. However, in principles and motives, the real essentials of life, they were one. And that was true. They were both idealists. "The Baineses were always strong for high ideals," she would say years later. "They talked about high ideals. We felt that you have to have a great purpose behind what you do, or no matter what you do, it won't amount to anything. Lyndon's father always felt the interest of the people was first," says Louise Casperus. "It was something to see how glad she always was to see him when he came home. There was never any question in my mind that these were two people who..." Louise's voice fades away at this point, and she expresses what she saw of their feelings by making a gesture with her arms, an embracing motion. And for a while it didn't seem to matter that Rebecca couldn't help Sam as his brother's wife helped him. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.